Chapter 7. Rated. Would your life get a good trust score? On the 14th of January 2014, the State Council of China published an ominous-sounding document called Planning Outline for the Construction of a Social Credit System. In the way of Chinese policy documents, it was a lengthy and rather dry affair, but it contained a radical idea. What if there was a national trust score that rated the kind of citizen you were? Imagine a world where many of your daily activities were constantly monitored and evaluated. What you buy at the store and online, where you are at any given time, who your friends are and how you interact with them, how many hours you spend watching content or playing video games, and what bills and taxes you pay or not. It's not hard to picture, because most of that already happens, thanks to all those data-collecting behemoths like Google, Facebook, and Instagram, or health-tracking apps such as Fitbit that can capture your moves and location at any given time. But now imagine a system where all these behaviors are rated as either positive or negative and distilled into a single number according to rules set by the government. That would create your citizen score, and it would tell everyone whether or not you were trustworthy. Plus, your rating would be publicly ranked against that of the entire population and used to determine your eligibility for a mortgage or a job, where your children can go to school, or even just your chances of getting a date. A futuristic vision of Big Brother out of control? No, it's already getting underway in China, where the government is developing a system to rate the trustworthiness of its 1.3 billion citizens. I'm sure George Orwell has already rolled over in his grave a couple of times in recent years, but this idea, called the social credit system, must have him doing frantic 360-degree turns in his coffin. The Chinese government is pitching the system as a desirable way to measure and enhance trust nationwide and to build a culture of sincerity. As the policy states, it will forge a public opinion environment where keeping trust is glorious. It will strengthen sincerity in government affairs, commercial sincerity, social sincerity, and the construction of judicial credibility. Others aren't so sanguine about its wider purpose. It is very ambitious in both depth and scope, including scrutinizing individual behavior and what books people are reading. It's Amazon's consumer tracking with an Orwellian political twist, is how Johan Lagerqvist, a Chinese internet specialist at the Swedish Institute of International Affairs, describes the social credit system. Dr. Roger Kremers, a postdoctoral scholar specializing in Chinese law and governance at the Van Vollenhoven Institute at Leiden University, who published a comprehensive translation of the plan, compared it to Yelp reviews with the nanny state watching over your shoulder. For now, technically, participating in China's citizen scores is voluntary, but by 2020 it will be mandatory. The behavior of every single citizen and legal person in China, which includes every company or other entity, will be rated and ranked whether they like it or not. Teachers, scientists, doctors, charity workers, government administrators, members of the judicial system, and even sports figures will be under special scrutiny. Big data will become the most important and most powerful driver to accelerate the modernization of governmental governance capacity, states the plan. Prior to the national rollout in 2020, the government is taking a watch-and-learn approach. In this marriage between communist oversight and capitalist can-do, the government has given a license to 8 private companies to come up with systems and algorithms for social credit scores. Predictably, data giants currently run two of the best-known projects. The first is with China Rapid Finance, a partner of the social network behemoth Tencent and developer of the messaging app WeChat, with more than 850 million active users. The other is run by the Ant Financial Services Group, an affiliate company of Alibaba, and is called Sesame Credit. Ant Financial sells insurance products and provides loans to small and medium-sized businesses. However, the real star of Ant is Alipay, its payments arm, which people use not only to buy things online, but also for restaurants, taxis, school fees, cinema tickets, and even to transfer money to each other. Sesame Credit has also teamed up with other data-generating platforms, such as Didi Chuxing, the ride-hailing company that was Uber's main competitor in China before it acquired the American company's Chinese operations in 2016, and Baihe, the country's largest online matchmaking service. It's not hard to see how that all adds up to gargantuan amounts of big data that Sesame Credit can tap into to assess how people behave and rate them accordingly. So just how are people rated? Individuals on Sesame Credit are measured by a score ranging between 350 and 950 points. Alibaba does not divulge the complex algorithm it uses to calculate the number, but they do reveal the five factors taken into account. The first is credit history. For example, does the citizen pay their electricity or phone bill on time? Do they repay their credit card in full? Next is fulfillment capacity, which it defines in its guidelines as a user's ability to fulfill his or her contract obligations. The third factor is personal characteristics, which is verifying personal information such as someone's mobile phone number and address. But it's the fourth category, behavior and preferences, where it gets interesting and some might say more sinister. Under this system, something as innocuous as a person's shopping habits become a measure of character. Alibaba admits it judges people by the types of product they buy. Someone who plays video games for 10 hours a day, for example, would be considered an idle person, says Li Yingyong, Sesame's technology director. Someone who frequently buys diapers would be considered as probably a parent who, on balance, is more likely to have a sense of responsibility. So if a citizen is buying socially approved items like baby supplies or work shoes, their score rises. But if they're buying Clash of Clans, Temple Run 2, or any video game, and thus looking like a lazy person, their score takes a negative hit. I wonder how long it will take to get to the point where the system can judge their behavior within a game. Maybe they will get a few points for being a nicer player by, say, helping another player's avatar in World of Warcraft. So the system not only investigates behavior, it shapes it. It nudges each of those closely monitored citizens away from purchases and behaviors the government does not like. And it's not just about purchases or pastimes. Friends matter too. The fifth category is interpersonal relationships. What do their choice of online friends and their interactions say about the person being assessed? Sharing what Sesame Credit refers to as positive energy online, nice messages about the government or how well the country's economy is doing, will make your score go up. For anyone who's read The Circle by Dave Eggers or seen the film, this might sound nightmarishly familiar. You and your ilk will live willingly, joyfully, under constant surveillance, watching each other always, commenting on each other, voting and liking and disliking each other, smiling and frowning and otherwise doing nothing much else, writes Eggers. Secrets are lies. Sharing is caring. Privacy is theft. Alibaba is adamant that currently anything negative posted on social media does not affect scores. We don't know if this is true or not because the algorithm is secret. But you can see how this might play out when the government's own citizen score system officially launches in 2020. Even though there is no suggestion yet that any of the 8 private companies involved in the ongoing pilot scheme will ultimately be responsible for running the government's own system, it's hard to believe that the government will not want to extract the maximum possible amount of data for its SCS from the pilots, particularly Alipay's Sesame and Tencent's WeChat. If that happens and continues as the new normal under the government's own SCS, it will result in private platforms acting essentially as spy agencies for the government. They may have no choice. Government and big internet companies in China can exploit big data together in a way that is unimaginable in the West, says Creamers. There are ample reasons to assume that whatever data the Chinese government wants, it can get. Posting dissenting political opinions or links mentioning Tiananmen Square has never been wise in China, but now it could directly hurt a citizen's rating. But here's the real kicker. The system could have a Kevin Bacon-like connection built in. A person's own score will depend on what their online friends say and do beyond their own contact with them. If someone they are connected to online posts a negative comment on, say, the Shanghai stock market collapse, a massive embarrassment to the Chinese regime, their own score will also be dragged down. Talk about guilt by association. So why have millions of people already signed up to what amounts to a trial run for a publicly endorsed government surveillance system? There may be darker, unstated reasons, fear of reprisals, for instance, for those who don't put their hand up. But there's also allure, in the form of rewards and special privileges, for those who show themselves to be trustworthy on Sesame Credit. If their score reaches 600, they can take out a Just Spend loan of up to 5,000 yuan, around $1,000, to use to shop online, as long as it's on an Alibaba site. Reach 650 points, they may rent a car without leaving a deposit. They are also entitled to faster check-in at hotels and use of the VIP check-in at Beijing Capital International Airport. Those with more than 666 points can get a cash loan of up to 50,000 yuan, more than $10,000, obviously from Ant Financial Services. Get above 700, they can apply for Singapore travel without supporting documents, such as an employee letter. And at 750, they can get fast-tracked application to a coveted pan-European Schengen visa. I think the best way to understand the system is as a sort of bastard love child of a loyalty scheme, says Roger Creamers. Like the trust system on eBay put together with an air miles type rewards program. Higher scores have already become a status symbol, with almost 100,000 people bragging about their scores on Weibo, the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, within months of launch. A citizen's score can even increase or decrease their odds of getting a date or a marriage partner, because the higher their Sesame rating, the more prominent their dating profile is on Baihui. A person's appearance is very important, but it's more important to be able to make a living, says Zhuang Yirong, vice president of Baihui. Your partner's fortune guarantees a comfortable life. More than 15% of Baihui users are currently choosing to display prominently their Sesame scores on their profiles. It shows how readily many people will buy into a system like this, apparently blind to all its other implications. Sesame Credit already offers tips to help individuals improve their ranking, including warning about the downsides of friending someone who has a low score. Undoubtedly, it won't be long before we see the rise of score advisors who will share tips on how to gain points, or reputation consultants willing to offer expert advice on how strategically to improve a ranking or get off the trust-breaking blacklist. I wonder if people will hire reputation auditors to look into the assessments made about them. It could be a lucrative new venture for accounting outfits like PricewaterhouseCoopers. We're also bound to see the birth of reputation black markets, selling under-the-counter ways to boost trustworthiness. In the same way that Facebook likes and Twitter followers can be paid for, and positive reviews on the darknet can be bought, individuals will pay to manipulate their score. But what happens to the poor and less educated people who can't afford or don't know how to enhance their score? Those who can't game or manipulate the system will be at a disadvantage. And what about keeping the system secure? Cyber hackers, some even state-backed, could go in and change or steal the digitally stored information. How much will a spouse or a future employee pay to purchase data on everything from the comments made in chat rooms to a history of every hotel room someone has checked into? It will give a whole new meaning to a background check. There's a compelling psychological reason people are willing to sign up to systems like this. Sesame Credit has tapped into a fundamental aspect of what makes us human: the desire to push ourselves to be better. We have been ranked and put on a curve since we were in primary school. Most of us are wired to want continually to level up, to score higher than others. We're caught on the hedonic treadmill, the term psychologists give to the desire to keep improving our current situation. We stay on it because satisfaction and happiness seem forever just out of reach. For instance, when we finally reach a longed-for salary level, we'll experience a temporary high, but before long we are hankering after more money. Or we post something on Facebook and it gets 121 likes. The pleasure soon gives way to a desire to post something that gets 125 or more likes. In the world of citizen scores, this means as soon as we reach one level, we not only will need but will want to ramp upwards. The desired social rung will always remain tantalizingly out of our grasp, making it almost impossible to be content with who and where we are. Sesame Credit plays on this in several ways. For example, it encourages users to guess whether they have a higher or lower score than their friends. When they check their own score, it also displays all their friends' scores. But it's not simply about competitiveness. It also means they can see who might be dragging them down. Conversely, people will be tempted to cultivate friends with good reputations for their own advantage. Want a loan to start a business? Better start being extra nice to influential people with high trust ratings and drop the losers. It will create some bizarre family dinner conversations. "Honey, I noticed your score dropped by 38 points today," says a wife to her husband. "You know we need to maintain a high score to get that home improvement loan. And have you forgotten that our family score goes on our son's college application next month? So what exactly did you do today, points-wise?" As I learned more and more about China's citizen scores, I kept thinking about the best-selling novel Super Sad True Love Story, which came out in 2010. It is set in a dystopian New York City in the not-too-distant future, and author Gary Steingart imagines credit polls lining the streets that publicly announce your credit rating as you pass by. Lenny Abramov, a Russian Jew and the main American character, is something of a throwback because he still believes in the unquantifiable qualities of individuals. His boss and everyone else tell him that that kind of touchy-feely stuff doesn't matter and that he needs to get his rating up. Supersad features a number of gadgets, and one that Lenny wears is an apparati, a neck pendant with Rate Me Plus technology. It broadcasts personal data such as life expectancy, current cholesterol levels, and even the wearer's sexual history. Let's say you walk into a bar. It says, "Okay, you're the third ugliest man in here, but you have the fifth best credit rating," explained Gary Steingart in an interview with The Atlantic. Forget beer goggles, even Google Glass. Apparati allows the wearer to check other people's ratings in real time to ensure they are not hooking up with someone dishonest, or at least rated as dishonest. It's not a very happy or trusting world. It's narcissistic, ruthless, and exhibitionist. And it might not be far off. Steingart's haunting satire is a commentary on society's obsession with needing to know where everyone else stands. It illustrates the perils of oversharing information with strangers and how everything from credit scores to health records could come to define us publicly and with grave consequences, despite the whole business being made to look like an enticing game. Indeed, Sesame Credit is basically a big data gamified version of the Communist Party's surveillance methods. The disquieting Dangan. The regime kept a dossier on every individual that tracked political and personal transgressions. A citizen's Dangan followed them for life, from schools to jobs. People started reporting on friends and even family members, raising suspicion and lowering social trust in China. The same thing will happen with digital dossiers. People will have an incentive to say to their friends, spouses, family, and colleagues, "Don't post that. I don't want you to hurt your score, but I also don't want you to hurt mine." The social pressure to conform to the party line and avoid any form of dissent will be immense. Negative or even contrary opinions will have no place. It's mind-blowing to imagine the sameness this system encourages, how it will stamp out individualism. Who will dare to speak out? Maya Wang, a spokesperson for Human Rights Watch China, based in Hong Kong, sees a scary vision of the future in the system. Currently, there is intensive surveillance of sensitive groups, such as dissidents, but the social credit system goes to another level. This is an effort of surveillance of all people, she says. Rogier Kremers wholeheartedly agrees with Wang. The aim in East Germany was limited to avoiding a revolt against the regime. The Chinese aim is far more ambitious. It is clearly an attempt to create a new citizen. The new system reflects a cunning paradigm shift. As we've noted, instead of trying to enforce stability or conformity with a big stick and a good dose of top-down fear, the government is attempting to make obedience feel like gaming. It is a method of social control dressed up in some points reward system. It's gamified obedience. In a trendy neighborhood in downtown Beijing, the BBC News services hit the streets in October 2015 to ask people about their Sesame credit ratings. Most of the residents spoke about the upsides. But then, who would publicly criticize the system? Ding, your score might go down. "It is very convenient," one young woman said, smiling at the camera and proudly showing the journalist the score on her phone. "We booked a hotel last night using Sesame Credit, and we didn't need to leave a cash deposit." Alarmingly, few people seem to understand that a bad score could hurt them in the future, preventing them, say, from signing a lease. Even more concerning was how many people, despite signing up for Sesame Credit, had no idea that they were being constantly rated. That kind of trusting ignorance is familiar, even if, in this case, it's taking place in a far more advanced form of dystopia. Think of all those Facebook users who were surprised to find out that they were being used as data lab rats. We sign up to all kinds of services without really knowing what we're agreeing to and what is in our control to reject if we choose to do so. Currently, Sesame Credit does not directly penalize people for being untrustworthy. It's far more effective to lock people in with treats for good behavior. But Hu Tao, Sesame Credit's chief manager, warns people that the system is designed so that untrustworthy people can't rent a car, can't borrow money, or even can't find a job. She has even disclosed that Sesame Credit has approached China's Education Bureau about sharing the list of its students who cheated in national examinations in order to make them pay in the future for their dishonesty. Penalties are set to change dramatically when the government system becomes mandatory in 2020. Indeed, on the 25th of September 2016, the State Council General Office updated its policy entitled Warning and Punishment Mechanisms for Persons Subject to Enforcement for Trust Breaking. The overriding principle is simple. If trust is broken in one place, restrictions are imposed everywhere, the policy document states. The punishments will seriously affect the social mobility of any transgressors. For instance, people with low ratings will have slower internet connectivity, restricted access to more desirable restaurants, nightclubs, or golf courses, and the removal of the right to travel freely abroad with, I quote, restrictive control on consumption within holiday areas or travel businesses. Scores will influence a person's rental application, their ability to get insurance, eligibility for a loan, and even social security benefits. Chinese citizens with low scores will not be hired by certain employers and will be forbidden altogether from obtaining some jobs, including in the civil service, journalism, and legal fields, where, of course, you must be deemed trustworthy. People who do not rate well will also be restricted when it comes to enrolling themselves or enrolling their children in high-paying private schools. I am not fabricating this list of punishments. It's the reality Chinese citizens will face. As the government document repeatedly states, the social credit system will allow the trustworthy to roam everywhere under heaven while making it hard for the discredited to take a single step. Once again, life mirrors art. The system is strikingly similar to an episode of Black Mirror, the critically acclaimed dystopian sci-fi television series. Each episode has a different cast, a different setting, even a different reality, notes Charlie Brooker, the creator of this darkly witty series. But they're all about the way we live now, and the way we might be living in 10 minutes' time if we're clumsy. Meaning, if we do not carefully handle new technologies, they will pull us into a strange future much sooner than we expect. Indeed, many of the imagined scenarios have since become reality, including a chatbot that mimics deceased relatives. Yes, this now exists. It's called Replica. And an obnoxious TV character who runs for political office to shake up a corrupt system. Not to mention a British PM who is forced to perform an insalubrious act with a pig on national television. Nosedive, the first episode of the third season, envisions a world in which each of us continuously chases after a desirable rating that sums up how people feel about us in real time. Your score, out of 5 stars, is affected by everyone, family members, friends, co-workers, and anonymous passers-by, and is used for everything, no matter how trivial. Did the barista pour a nice swirl of milk on your coffee? You can reward him for that. Did a woman look you up and down the wrong way in your 30-second elevator ride? You can make her pay for that. Be warned, though, your own rating might fall if she returns fire and rates you negatively. The main character, Lacey Pound, lives her life constantly trying to please everyone in exchange for a few precious points. She has to work hard to maintain her solid but not outstanding 4.2 rating. She even practices her fake smile in the bathroom mirror every morning. Her value in this world is equivalent to her points, which she checks obsessively after every tiny interaction. What does Lacey's life tell us about the way the world is moving? Luciano Floridi, Professor of Philosophy and Ethics of Information at the University of Oxford and the Director of Research at the Oxford Internet Institute, has an interesting way of framing it. Many make the claim to be an expert on digital disruption, but Floridi is the real deal. He's currently serving as the only ethicist on Google's advisory committee on the European Union's Right to be Forgotten ruling. It's a role that has seen him crowned Google's philosopher. According to Floridi, there have been three critical decentering shifts that have altered our view in self-understanding: Copernicus's model of the Earth orbiting the Sun, Darwin's theory of natural selection, and Freud's claim that our daily actions are controlled by the unconscious mind. Floridi believes we are now entering the fourth shift in our world, as what we do online and offline merge into an on-life. He asserts that as our world increasingly becomes an infosphere, a mixture of physical and virtual experiences, we are acquiring on-life personality, different from who we innately are in the real world alone. We see this writ large on Facebook, where people present a carefully edited or idealized portrait of their lives. When I look at some of my friends' streams, beautiful pictures of holidays and their kids angelically dressed up in costumes, I wonder, is this the same friend complaining about her husband and bratty five-year-old? I do the same. I edit the flaws and inconsistencies in my life, disguising my true, messy self. In Black Mirror, Lacey's on-life personality is the extreme version of the future Floridi is talking about. Her life has become an exhausting, dramatic public performance. She has discovered that the only way she can afford her dream apartment is by raising her rating, so she visits a score counselor for advice. Then, out of the blue, Naomi, an old school friend and social media star with a higher rating, asks Lacey to be maid of honor at her wedding. With many prime influencers, high-ranking wedding guests, attending, Lacey is convinced a tear-jerking bridesmaid speech will get her the upvotes she needs. The speech, of course, turns into a disaster, but that's not the point here. Or maybe it is. The rating system in Black Mirror is based on social approval, on likes and stars. As we see with Lacey, it encourages people to base relationships on personal gain and to fake behavior. Disturbingly, that episode is not very far from the on-life we are living right now. Think about your Uber experiences. Are you just a little bit nicer and friendlier to the driver because you know you will also be rated? Indeed, judgment and scores are a two-way street. Some days I like my conversations with drivers. I appreciate the serendipitous connections that sometimes emerge because I sit in the front and we talk. However, there are times I wish my Uber ride could be a simple transaction, where the driver does not know my name or have a picture of me, where I feel no pressure to be nice, where I am not asked what I do or how many kids I have. I once berated my husband down the phone during a trip because he told me he was running late again. I was tired. It hadn't been a particularly good day. The driver said to me, "If I were your husband and you shouted like that, I would be late." It's rude that I shouted in his car, but frankly, it's none of his business. The pressure to be rated means I'm tempted to be falsely polite and not authentic. Yet it's not as if I'm unused to being rated and reviewed. After a speech, I can see exactly how many people thought it was fantastic or a waste of time. People like or dislike my talks on TED, my slides on SlideShare, and my posts on Medium. My students at Oxford break my teaching ability down into a detailed survey. People send me not just complimentary remarks, but also scathing comments about my ideas and articles. I have learned to be comfortable having all my imperfections pointed out, And even so, I still worry about how I measure up on an Uber ride. I'm human. I need to be liked. And more to the point, I want drivers to continue to pick me up. Yet I don't want to worry ceaselessly about how I'm being rated, whether I'm late or punctual, rude or a darling, dirty or clean. I'm frightened of ending up like Lacey. I'm frightened my children will live in a society where scores become the ultimate truth of who they are. A paranoid world where they are under never-ending pressure to present an idealized portrait of their lives, not just for likes, but because of fear of how they're measuring up against others, minute by minute, year by year, and how it will affect their future prospects. How will I teach them what it means to be your authentic self? The information we liberally post about ourselves today might end up being rated in some way down the track, but that doesn't stop us. We have become hooked, literally, on displaying our lives and doings. A few years ago, Diana Tamir, an associate professor of psychology at Princeton University, and Jason Mitchell of Harvard's neuroscience lab published a paper titled "Disclosing Information About the Self is Intrinsically Rewarding." Surveys of internet use show that more than 80% of posts to social media sites consist simply of announcements about a user's immediate experience, such as what they are about to eat for dinner. The researchers asked participants to undergo functional magnetic resonance imaging scans while making these kinds of posts to see what happens to their brains. And what happens is that our reward centers light up, just as they do with primary rewards such as food and sex. That is why we strive to post more. As Dave Eggers brilliantly puts it, it's the addictive digital social equivalent of snack food, endless empty calories, and it's far from nourishing. Uber ratings are nothing compared to People, an app launched in March 2016, which is like Yelp for humans. It allows you to assign ratings and reviews to everyone you know: your neighbor, your boss, your teacher, your spouse, and even your ex. A profile displays a people number, a score based on all the feedback and recommendations you receive. Worryingly, once someone puts your name in the people system, it's there, and there's nothing you can do about it. You can't opt out. You must use your real name to leave a review, be over 21, and of course, have a Facebook account. You must also affirm that you know the person you are rating based on one of three categories: professional, personal, or dating. That is, how good they are at dating. The app is basically allowing you to judge and publicly reduce people to a grade without consent. Sound familiar? People has forbidden certain bad behaviors, including mentioning private health conditions, expressing profanities, or being sexist, however you objectively assess that. There are, however, very few rules on how people are graded or standards about transparency. The app does include a feature called a truth license. According to the company's press release, the People Truth License shows you everything that has been written about a person, whether it was published live on their profile or not. This allows you to make better decisions about the people around you. One of the key reasons why Nicole McCulloch, People co-founder and a mother of two, developed the app was that in a world where people don't know their neighbours, she wanted help to decide whom to trust with her kids. Fittingly, the founders have been publishing a reality documentary on YouTube about every step involved in building People. It doesn't matter how far apart we are in likes or dislikes, co-founder Julia Cordray tells a total stranger in a bar in episode 10 of the YouTube documentary. All that matters is what people say about us. What are the consequences of boxing people into a number and a value? This question comes to life in a particularly memorable scene in Black Mirror. Lacey is at the airport on her way to Naomi's wedding. Dressed like a pink pastel daydream, she approaches the check-in counter, all smiles. When she places her phone on the scanner, her details, including her rating and PMA, positive mental attitude, flash on the check-in agent's screen. Unfortunately, her flight is cancelled and the airline representative can't book her onto another standby flight because Lacey's social credit score has dropped. On the way to the airport, her score dipped to a 4.183 after she got into a squabble with a woman while getting into her taxi. Her explanation doesn't matter. The system automatically blocks the agent from booking her onto the flight without the correct 4.2 rating. She ends up hitching a ride with a female truck driver who has a dismal 1.4 rating. The trucker shares the moving story of how she, too, was obsessed with her rating until her husband got terminal cancer. He was denied treatment he badly needed. It was given to another patient with a higher score. "So I figure," the trucker tells Lacey with a smile, "fuck it." It makes me wonder, will we see similar movements of anti-rating people happy to be poorly ranked? Black Mirror has become somewhat of a magic eight ball, predicting the future. China's trust system might be voluntary as yet, but it's already having Lacey-like consequences. In February 2017, China's Supreme People's Court announced that 6.15 million people in the country had been banned from taking flights over the past 4 years for social misdeeds. The travel ban is being pointed to as the first indication of how people blacklisted in the social credit system, so-called trust breakers, will be punished. "We have signed a memorandum with over 44 government departments in order to limit discredited people on multiple levels," says Meng Xiang, head of the Executive Department of the Supreme Court. "Another 1.65 million people cannot take trains because they are on the social credit blacklist for misdemeanors. They have been downgraded and branded as second-class citizens. This isn't TV. It isn't marketing. It's reality." Where these systems really descend into nightmarish territory is that the trust algorithms used are unfairly reductive. They don't tell the whole story. They don't take into account context and valid reasons for a bad day. For instance, one person might miss paying a bill or a fine because they were in hospital. Another may simply be a freeloader. But there is no one sitting and analyzing every citizen's score assessment going, "Oh, okay, she was having an operation and that explains why she didn't pay her credit card." And therein lies the urgent challenge facing all of us in the digital world, and not just the Chinese. If life-determining algorithms are here to stay, and it certainly looks that way, we need to figure out how they can embrace the nuances, inconsistencies, and contradictions inherent in human beings. We need to work out how they can reflect real life. You could see China's so-called trust plan as Orwell's 1984 meets Pavlov's dogs. Act like a good citizen, be rewarded, and be made to think you're having fun. It's worth remembering, however, that personal scoring systems have been present in the West for decades. More than 70 years ago, two men called Bill Fair and Earl Isaac invented credit scores. They met at Stanford University in San Jose, California, where Fair was studying engineering and Isaac mathematics. They started their own company with just $400 apiece. The goal was to use predictive analytics and the newfangled capabilities of computers to give lenders a unified view of a person's credit risk. Specifically, the duo wanted to use algorithms to study customers' past behavior, predict future behavior, and come up with a credit score. At the time, it was regarded as a radical concept. Initially, the idea of credit scores didn't take off. Pear and Isaac sent a letter to 50 of the largest lenders in the United States, offering them the new technology. Only one responded. But in 1958, the first credit score, known today as FICO, short for the Fair Isaac Corporation, was created. Over the years, it has positively challenged many lenders' practices and prejudices. "Good credit does not wear a coat and tie," was the headline on one advertisement. FICO proved time and again that race, for example, was not a predictor of good credit risk and refused to put it into their scoring system. Today, companies use FICO scores to determine many financial decisions, including the interest rate on our mortgage or whether we should be given a loan. The score range is 300 to 850, with the high number representing less risk to the lender or insurer. Remarkably, it wasn't until 2003 that we could find out our actual score. Before then, they had been kept a secret. And despite the significance of credit scores to our lives, repeated studies show that more than 60% of Americans still do not know their score or simply have not bothered to find out. For the majority of Chinese people, it is not a case of knowing or not. In a catch-22, they have never had credit scores, and so they can't get credit. Many people don't own houses, cars, or credit cards in China, so that kind of information isn't available to measure, explains Wen Quan, an influential blogger who writes about technology and finance. The central bank has the financial data from 800 million people, but only 320 million have a traditional credit history. According to the Chinese Ministry of Commerce, the annual economic loss caused by lack of credit information is more than 600 billion yuan, approximately $97 billion. China's lack of a national credit system is why the government is adamant that citizen scores are long overdue and badly needed to fix what they refer to as a trust deficit. In a poorly regulated market, the sale of counterfeit and substandard products is a massive problem. According to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, 63% of all fake goods, from watches to handbags to baby food, originate from China. In late 2008, the Chinese Ministry of Health revealed 6 babies had died and almost 300,000 had fallen ill after drinking baby formula deliberately laced with melamine, a toxic chemical used in plastics and fertilizer. Turns out a local manufacturer had intentionally added the industrial chemical to mask low protein levels in watered-down formula. Since this massive breach of trust, Chinese customers have bought baby formula milk, loads of it, from overseas, so much so that some big British retailers such as Boots and Sainsbury's decided to set a 2-can limit to prevent bulk buying to feed the Chinese market, leaving a shortage of tins on the shelves. In January 2017, Chinese authorities discovered a production hub of around 50 factories that were generating counterfeit products designed to look exactly like well-known brands. Jack Ma has called fake goods cancer to Alibaba, but crackdown efforts to weed out fakes have had an uphill battle. Food security, counterfeiting, and a lack of regulatory compliance are real issues for Chinese citizens. The level of micro-corruption is enormous, says Roger Cremiers. Up and down the ladder, trust is a huge problem in China. So if this particular scheme results in more effective oversight and accountability, it will likely be warmly welcomed. The government also argues that the system is a way to bring in those people left out of traditional credit systems, such as students, low-income households, and those who have never borrowed money. Professor Wang Shukin from the Office of Philosophy and Social Science at Capital Normal University in China recently won the bid to help the government develop the system that she refers to as China's social faithful system. Without such a mechanism, doing business in China is risky, she stresses, as about half of the signed contracts are not kept. Especially given the speed of the digital economy, it is crucial that people can quickly verify each other's creditworthiness, she says. The behavior of the majority is determined by their world of thoughts. A person who believes in socialist core values is behaving more decently. In other words, she regards the moral standards the system assesses, as well as financial data, as a bonus. Indeed, the State Council's primary objective is to raise the honest mentality and credit levels of the entire society in order to improve the overall competitiveness of the country. In other words, the government is selling citizen scores as a tool to evaluate people more fairly and improve economic vitality. Is it remotely possible that the social credit system in China is in fact a more desirably transparent approach to surveillance in a country that has a long history of watching its citizens? As a Chinese person, knowing that everything I do online is being tracked, would I rather be aware of the details of what is being monitored and use this information to teach myself how to abide by the rules of government? Asks Rasul Majid, a Chinese blogger based in Shanghai who writes about behavioral design and gaming psychology. Or would I rather live in ignorance and hope slash wish slash dream that personal privacy still exists and that our ruling bodies respect us enough not to take advantage? Put simply, Majid thinks that the system gives him a tiny bit more control over his data. On the one hand, a social credit system will almost certainly encourage people to act more honestly and to abide by the rules. On the other, it's a deeply disturbing version of reputation economics that will give governments unprecedented control over what they consider good and bad ways to behave. When I tell people living in the Western world about the social credit system in China, their responses are fervent, visceral. After a speech I gave at a financial conference, a female banker remarked, "We routinely do things that just 5 years ago would have made no sense to us, but that idea is batshit crazy." Her sense of alarm was typical. Many people have asked if it is really true, if it's really happening in China. Surprisingly, very few people ask the more pertinent question, could this happen in the Western world? Or rather, when can we expect it? We already rate restaurants, movies, books, and even doctors. We've seen how people rates people. You can even rate your bowel movements online. Check out ratemypoo.com if you don't believe me. Yelpers, customers who regularly leave reviews on Yelp, will threaten hotels and restaurants with poor reviews if they don't please them by giving them, say, complimentary drinks. Authors have Amazon scores. Airbnb hosts and guests have cleanliness scores. Teachers have RateMyProfessors.com scores. Errand runners on TaskRabbit, Deliveroo drivers, and a whole plethora of other gig workers are rated, and they rate customers back. Clout scores that claim to identify the most influential social media users are even appearing on some people's resumes as proof of their stellar reputation. Fitbit captures how much you move, or don't, and gives you a fitness score that it shares with multiple companies. On an app called Date Check, you can even do an instant background check on someone you've just met in a bar. Its tagline is, fittingly, "Look up before you hook up." Facebook is now capable of identifying you in pictures without seeing your face. It only needs your clothes, hair, and body type to tag you in an image with 83% accuracy. It's kind of like how I can recognize my husband from 100 meters away by his gait. In 2015, the OECD published a study revealing that in the United States, there are at least 24.9 connected devices per every 100 inhabitants. All kinds of companies scrutinize the big data emitted from these devices to understand our lives, desires, and psyches, and to predict our future actions in ways that we couldn't even predict for ourselves. When I get on the bus on my way to work, I put on my headphones. It's a morning ritual that gives me some sense of personal privacy in a crowded public space. My listening habits, especially the podcasts, audiobooks, and news programs I download, would provide a clear window into my political preferences, life stresses, religious views, and various other interests. So what would happen if someone knew what I was listening to? On the 18th of April 2017, a class action lawsuit filed in a federal court in Chicago accused a high-end audio equipment maker of spying on its customers' listening habits. After paying $350 for his Quiet Comfort 35 headphones, Kyle Zack, the lead plaintiff in the case, followed Bose's suggestion to get the most out of your headphones by downloading its Connect app to his smartphone. He provided his name, email address, and headphone serial number as part of the sign-up process. And like most of us, he handed over his information without much thought. The app adds functions such as the ability to customize the level of noise cancellation in the headphones. But the app also tracks the music, podcasts, and other audio Bose customers listen to, and violates privacy rights by selling the information to various third parties, including a data mining company called Segment.io. Shortly after the lawsuit was filed, Bose responded with a company statement. "We'll fight the inflammatory, misleading allegations made against us through the legal system. Nothing is more important to us than your trust. We work tirelessly to earn and keep it, and have for over 50 years. That's never changed and never will." Regardless of the final legal outcome, the Bose case sparked further questions about the ethics of data collection. The fact is, many companies are not transparent about the data they take and what they're doing with it, or clear about how they monetize our personal information. And this applies to everything from coffee machines to headphones, running shoes to even sex toys. In 2017, WeVibe paid more than $3.75 million to resolve privacy claims regarding vibrators remotely controlled with a Connect Lover smartphone app. The sex toys were secretly collecting customer data, including highly intimate details such as the date and time of each use, temperature settings, and what vibration intensity and mode users selected, all of which were linked to owners' personal email addresses. What if the data was hacked? Do we want companies, or even governments, to know how we spend our most personal time and the details of our orgasms? In April 2017, another smart sex toy faced a massive security glitch over intimate surveillance. Svakon Simei, a $249 app-enabled vibrator, has a tiny built-in camera designed for either private live streaming or to know the subtle changes inside of your private areas. The default password on the device is 8888888. If it's not reset, the device can be easily hacked. What's more, the manufacturer, Standard Innovations, can geolocate whenever the vibrator is in use. Smartphones and computer webcams can be co-opted for commercial and nefarious purposes. Next in line as potential spies are the digital voice assistants, such as Amazon's Echo smart speaker called Alexa, now entering millions of our homes. Her tagline is, fittingly, "Just ask." The artificially intelligent assistant is happy to help with all kinds of requests, such as, "Alexa, what's on my calendar today?" or, "Alexa, play the Coldplay song I like." And of course, she is especially handy in buying things, from Amazon, that is. But what if she was asked to assist with, say, a murder trial? In November 2015, Victor Collins, a police officer from Arkansas, was found floating dead in the hot tub of his friend James Andrew Bates, who became a suspect. 2 years later, attorney Nathan Smith, the lead prosecutor in the first-degree murder trial, ordered Amazon to hand over the audio recordings from Bates's digital assistant, used in the Echo speakers in his home. While it's unlikely any alleged murderer would have asked, "Alexa, how do I strangle somebody and hide a body?" The prosecution felt the recording might provide valuable clues as to what happened at Bates's house the night Collins was found dead. Amazon's attorneys contended the digital assistant has First Amendment rights, protecting information gathered and sent by the device. Bates, however, told Amazon it could hand over the information. Maybe he believed it would prove his innocence, although it's also possible Bates thought the Echo device was only recording snippets of audio during the few seconds during and after hearing a command. Aside from the other issues, the case raises a key question. How can you know when your always connected digital assistant is recording what you say? And it is not just tech companies that are in on this. Governments around the world are already engaged in the business of monitoring, rating, and labeling their own citizens. The National Security Agency is not the only government digital eye in the U.S. following the movements of citizens' lives. In 2015, the U.S. Transportation Security Administration quietly proposed the idea of expanding the pre-check background checks, the ones that give you faster transport through security, to include social media records, location data, and purchase history. The idea was scrapped after heavy criticism, but that doesn't mean it's dead. Indeed, in February 2017, President Trump put forward a proposal to force some people entering the country to hand over their social media passwords for Facebook, Twitter, Google+, Instagram, YouTube, LinkedIn, and others, so authorities could view their internet activity. The U.S. government has said the extreme vetting rule will apply predominantly to travelers from the 7 Muslim countries, Iraq, Iran, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, and Libya, named in the controversial travel ban. We want to get on their social media with passwords. What do you do? What do you say? Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly told the Homeland Security Committee, if they don't want to cooperate, then you don't come in. If you are still unconvinced that privacy is not merely in peril but already extinct, consider this. Uber has a tool it rather ominously calls GodView. Until recently, it allowed all employees to access and track where and when any Uber rider travels to or from, in real time and without obtaining any kind of permission. Running late to a meeting? Uber could know why. Shockingly, the company could analyze data to predict rides of glory, the term used in a blog by an Uber data scientist to describe tracking sexual rendezvous. Those were customers Uber called Rogers, who booked rides between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. on weekend nights and then took a second ride home a few hours later from the previous drop-off point, presumably after one-night stands. In 2014, Emil Michael, a senior vice president at Uber, took the company's God view one step further. He suggested using the tool to monitor the rider logs and location of a Pando Daily reporter called Sarah Lacey, an outspoken Uber critic who had recently accused Uber of sexism and misogyny. What's more, the executive boasted at a dinner party attended by the likes of actor Ed Norton and Arianna Huffington that the company should spend $1 million to use location data to dig up dirt on other journalists who had been critical of Uber to silence them. His proposal was to look into your personal lives, your families, and give the media a taste of its own medicine. The Sarah Lacey incident resulted in a lawsuit led by the New York Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, that was settled in January 2016. This settlement protects the personal information of Uber riders from potential abuse by company executives and staff, including the real-time locations of riders in an Uber vehicle, said Attorney General Schneiderman. As part of the settlement, Uber had to pay a measly $20,000 in fines, and GodView can now only be used by a select number of designated employees and only for legitimate business purposes. Phew. Problem solved. Hardly. We already live in a world of predictive algorithms that determine if we are a profitable customer, a threat, a risk, a good citizen, and even if we are a trustworthy person. We are getting closer to the Chinese system, the expansion of credit scoring into life scoring, even if we don't know it's happening. Photos, books, music, films, friendships, and even money have been digitized. We are now in the early stages of digitizing identity and reputation. So are we inexorably headed for a future where we will all be branded online and data mined? It's certainly trending that way. Barring some kind of mass citizens' revolt to wrench back privacy and personal information, we are entering an age where an individual's actions will be judged by standards they can't control and where that judgment cannot be erased. The consequences are not only troubling, they are permanent. Forget the right to delete and the right to be forgotten. Forget being young and foolish. It's why, at the very least, we urgently need to find a way to create forgiveness for moments of madness, ineptitude, or cheating. Deletion should not be outlawed. Human beings, with all our imperfections, are so much more than a number. While it might be too late to stop this new era, we do have choices and rights we need to be exerting now. For one thing, we need to be able to rate the raters. In his book The Inevitable, Kevin Kelly describes a future where the watchers and the watched will transparently and ceaselessly track each other. Our central choice now is whether this surveillance is a secret one-way panopticon or a mutual, transparent kind of coveyance that involves watching the watchers, he writes. The first option is hell. The second, redeemable. Our trust should start with individuals within government, or whichever organization is controlling the system. We need trustworthy mechanisms to make sure the ratings and data are used responsibly and with our permission. To trust the system, as we have seen, we need to reduce the unknowns. That means taking steps to reduce the opacity of the scoring algorithms. The argument against mandatory disclosures is that if you know what happens under the bonnet, the system becomes more vulnerable to being rigged or hacked. But if humans are being reduced to a rating that could have a significant impact on their lives, there must be full transparency in how the scoring works. In China, it seems likely that certain citizens, such as government officials and business leaders, will be deemed to be above the system. What will be the public reaction when their unfavorable actions don't seem to affect their score? We could see a Panama Papers version 3 for reputation fraud. It is still too early to know how a culture of constant monitoring plus rating will turn out. What will happen when these systems charting the social, moral, and financial history of an entire population come into full force? How much further will privacy and freedom of speech, long under siege in China, be eroded? Who will decide which way the system goes? These are questions we all need to consider, and very soon. Today, China, tomorrow, a place near you. The real questions about the future of trust are not technological or economic, they are ethical. Indeed, if we are not vigilant, distributed trust could become networked shame, and life will become one endless popularity contest with us all feverishly vying for the highest ratings that only a few can attain.